So what do I know about the stock market?
But yeah, I think it's an enjoyable. It's something you'll remember the rest of your lives. When your kids, your children, or your nephews and nieces someday are going to say, "Were you around when Obama got elected?" And you'll say, "Yeah, it was a crazy time," and all that. So it's going to, of course, he's going to face now enormous expectations. So we talk about concepts like risk and generalization and all these things, and you can actually make analogies of those to his situation. But now he essentially has a situation where the priors are very high, right? So there's great expectations, and it's going to be very hard for him to satisfy people's expectations, because no matter how well he does, it's going to be possible to meet what people expect of him. So today, I am pleased to present this math variant estimation. Sundar was not here yet, and I've been working on these slides, so I don't want to take all the credit for them, but I think we have a nice set of slides that I actually should have presented before the last lecture. So next time I offer the course, we'll reorder the slides. But what I want to do today is to talk about what is a conjugate prior. This is a concept which really came to the forefront with Bayesian estimation, and it's something certainly I never heard about when I was a graduate student. I mean, the whole Bayesian thing was not really popular when I was a graduate student. And I think it's good to get some exposure to that. So we'll spend some time. Okay, so our remote site's dialing in. Looks like one person's maybe out there. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
We'll talk about what is a conjugate prior. I'll give you a few examples. There's actually a pretty nice Wikipedia page on this, and I'm really surprised at how many different conjugate priors exist. This is an area fairly new in statistics. Not really new, but it's within the last 15, 20 years that it's come to the forefront. And we'll talk about why these distributions are so important, and hopefully make you think a little bit about whether this is truly the right thing to do. And I'll maybe make some comments about techniques that try to circumvent the need to have these conjugate priors. And then we'll spend some time on actually deriving the map variance estimate. I wanted to go through this because the map variance estimate for a scalar parameter does use this, most of the concepts that we talk about when we derive the map re-estimation equations for the HMMs. It uses conjugate priors and Wishart distributions and things like that. But it's a much more tractable derivation. We can follow it step by step. So hopefully when you see that, then you'll be able to go back and look at that paper, and more of what's in that paper will make sense. So recall that in our maximum a posteriori or map formulation, we are trying to maximize a likelihood, posterior, that involves, we have the likelihood, the bold lowercase o, our observations. We have the probability of the observations given the parameters times the prior of the parameters divided by those same things integrated over all possible values of the parameters. We call the bottom of the evidence. We talked about the fact that since the denominator is essentially a scalar, we can ignore it in the maximization process. We see that over and over in these Bayesian type methods. And in the map formulation, we let the likelihood function be considered fixed. And the likelihood function is usually well determined from a statement of the data generating process. That means we typically have, in the Bayesian approaches, what we're really focused on is trying to optimize for the prior, trying to understand what the shape of the prior might be, what the parameters of the prior might be. We assume that the likelihood function is well known. Now, typically what we'll do in a real application is we'll alternate between the two. We'll do some work on estimating the prior. Once we've got that, we'll do some work on estimating the likelihood, and we'll go back and forth between those until we get the overall maximum that we're looking for. So from time to time, we'll say things like, well, let's solve for the variance assuming the mean is known. And you might be saying, well, but wait, we don't know the mean, but that's just that two-step process. Assume we've previously estimated the mean, we try to estimate the variance, and then we flip, assume the variance is known, and we estimate the mean. Now, we have discussed the need to assume a form for the prior distribution, G of theta, that makes the mathematics tractable, and yet is a reasonable model. And that is a big statement, because you look at these distributions that we're talking about, things like Dirichlet densities and normal Wishart densities, and you sort of wonder, well, why on earth would these be a reasonable model of the prior? Wouldn't a Gaussian model be much safer, much more consistent with Occam's razor principles and things like that? And I don't really have a good answer to that, other than that's what the Bayesian people do. And in practice, I think it works out okay in most cases, but it doesn't mean that it's the best approach. There's a lot of people who do not believe in Bayesian methods. The Bayesian community is fairly strong and fairly religious, so there's a big divide between the two. Now, a conjugate prior, and you know that name, sometimes you wonder, they think that these names, I mean, I understand why they use this name, but I think they could have used a better name. But it's essentially referred to as a choice of the prior, a choice of G of theta that makes the posterior P of O given theta times G of theta have the same form, or what's often called the class, as the prior. It can have different parameters. Of course, typically the means and variances of the overall posterior will be different than the means and variances of the prior, but you want the form to be the same. So this is sort of a self-generating process. You take the prior times the posterior, and you get back a function which is the same shape as the prior. Now, one way to look at that is that a conjugate prior is an algebraic convenience. With that property, you can often find fairly tractable equations, as we've shown for the mean, and as we'll show for the variance. You can work out typically closed-form solutions. If you did not choose the conjugate prior, you chose some other distribution, typically you'll end up with a set of complex equations that you might have to solve numerically, or you might have to solve with some simplifying assumptions, but you would not end up with the relatively simple and straightforward equations that we do when we use a conjugate prior. So that's one reason, that's sort of a convenience reason. A second reason, though, and I think this is actually probably more important in practice, is that another important reason to use a conjugate prior relates to the way we iteratively estimate the parameters. It is common to assume a prior, estimate a posterior from that prior, and then use the posterior as a prior to estimate the posterior for some additional data. So the way that would work is we assume some prior, P sub zero of theta, we estimate, and we have our we have a new data set, O sub 1. This is sort of what we're looking at today. We have prior estimates, I give you some new data, and then you try to estimate the new posterior. But typically what we'll do then is we'll then take that posterior and use that as the prior to go and estimate a new posterior based on some new data. And if the forms of, if we're seeing a change in form from P0 to P1, then likely we'll see a change in form from P1 to P2. And if the shape of the distribution is always changing, then you're going to have a new set of equations for each iteration of the estimation process. And that would be really inconvenient. So with the use of the conjugate prior, we can be assured the form of the distribution will not change with each iteration, and then we can simply reuse the estimation equations with each iteration. So that's, I think, a more compelling reason why it makes sense to use a conjugate prior. Okay, everybody okay with this so far? Now, some examples of conjugate priors. When we've developed the map estimate of the mean, I sort of glossed over this, but we had a the likelihood function was a product of the likelihoods of the individual observations, O sub I, and we had N of those, and we said, well, they're jointly Gaussian, and we're going to assume independence, so we can say that the likelihood of the observations is just a product of the individual likelihoods, and we wrote that in terms of a product of Gaussian distributions. Then we said that the prior for the mean, and this is what will be different from the derivation we're doing for the variance. The prior of the mean was we were going to model as a Gaussian distribution. And we said, well, that is actually a conjugate prior because the product of these two is also a Gaussian distribution, just in this case. And it has a different mean and variance. There's a mean which is the sum of these two means. But the overall shape of the posterior is still a Gaussian, and hence the Gaussian prior in this case of unknown mean and a Gaussianly distributed data is considered a conjugate prior. Now, if you try to apply this to the variance, you don't get that same luxury because essentially you've got this variance in the denominator, and that sort of screws things up. With the mean, everything's in the numerator, and you get this nice addition of these two. But with the variance, it doesn't work out that way. So Sundar and I actually did try just as an example to try to derive the re-estimation equations assuming a Gaussian prior for the variance, which I think actually makes sense, but the equations are just not tractable. So that's one example. Gaussian prior is conjugate prior for estimation of the mean, not conjugate prior for estimation of the variance. A more classic example of this, which I thought was worth going through, this actually comes from the Wikipedia page, is a binomial distribution. If you're not familiar with what are called Bernoulli experiments or binomial distributions, this is essentially how you measure probability when you're doing a series of experiments like coin tosses. And you have in two outcomes, heads or tails, or success or failure, as they often like to call it. And you want to ask questions like, what is the probability that if I flip a coin n times, k of those flips will be a head, and n minus k of those will be tails. And you can model that probability space, you can model as a binomial distribution. Binomial distributions have a lot of really interesting properties, and I've really come to learn a lot more of those in looking through the literature the last few days on this stuff. It's there's a lot of really deep statistical theory here. The conjugate prior, and you may recall that in the HMM derivation, we used what was called a multinomial, and that's why I wanted to introduce this. So the conjugate prior for a binomial distribution is what's called a beta distribution. It's very similar in shape to a binomial. The beta distribution is defined as p to the alpha minus 1 times 1 minus p to the beta minus 1 over this constant term, which is a beta function of alpha and beta. And if you're interested in what the definition of the beta function is, that's defined in terms of a ratio of gamma functions. If you're interested in what a gamma function is, that's defined, and it just goes on. So I won't try to elaborate on that because typically what we do with these conjugate priors is we simply want a proportionality. We don't need an exact equality. So we can throw away the denominator term and just write that the shape of the conjugate prior for the binomial distribution is just this p to the alpha minus 1 times 1 minus p to the beta minus 1. The minus 1s, well, they're introduced as a notational convenience so that when you actually do the derivation, everything kind of works out nicely. You could, in theory, do them without the minus 1s, but it's a little more convenient to have them there separated out from the constants. Now, the other thing to remember here, and this is something that Sundar and I are still struggling with a little bit. When we assumed a Gaussian prior, it's pretty straightforward to say, well, if we're trying to estimate the mean of a distribution, that is a Gaussian distribution with a mean mu sub m, and that mu sub m represents essentially the expected value of the mean we're trying to estimate. So it's sort of like the prior mean, you could say. So there's a nice relationship. We're trying to estimate the mean, and we have to do that in terms of two parameters, a mean, the prior mean, and the prior variance, which we don't necessarily know. We're going to have to estimate those from some prior data. Now, with this with the binomial distribution, most often we're concerned with this value p, which is the probability of one of the events, success, for example. But this distribution is defined in terms of these two parameters in alpha and beta, which don't have this direct correlation with what we're trying to estimate. So it's a little bit more indirect. And therefore, it's a little harder to see the relation of these alphas and betas to, you could say, the problem at hand, flipping a coin. If if you ask me, well, what's the prior? I've got 1 million prior tosses of a coin. What's the right value in alpha and beta? Well, it's not as easy to say, well, those relate to the mean or those relate to the variance. You can derive the mean and variance of this distribution in terms of these alphas and betas, and then you can actually fit that distribution to your prior data and compute the optimal values of alpha and beta. So you can estimate those in a data-driven way, and that's a concept that we're going to continually make use of in this, but there's no direct relation. You can't say, well, you know, the mean number of heads is equal to alpha and the mean number of tails is equal to beta. Now, I hope, is that clear? Because that gets a little bit more complicated when we start introducing some of these more exotic distributions like the Wishart distributions, which have some parameters associated with them. And you look at these parameters, and if it doesn't jump out at you how these parameters relate to the data. But the key thing to remember is they're just parameters, and they can always be estimated on prior data to optimize the shape of that distribution to fit the data as best it can. So they're just some parameters that we're going to have to optimize on offline training data. So the posterior in this case then is the product of these two things. It's essentially the probability that this parameter P is the probability of success, and that we drew K trials of that event. And that the product of these two is essentially n things K at a time. If you're not familiar with this, this is just n factorial over K factorial times n minus K factorial, times P to the K times 1 minus P to the n minus K, times this, prior, which is p to the alpha minus 1 times 1 minus p to the beta minus 1. And you can begin to see why exponential distributions are so popular, because now what happens is the arguments just add, and we're left with a new beta distribution which simply has a new value. You could call this alpha primed, that's k plus alpha, and a beta primed, which is n minus k plus beta. So the shape of the distribution is again a beta distribution, but the parameters associated with that distribution shift a little. And this is why in the HMM derivation, we got to a point where we had something like u prime is equal to u plus some constant, because using the posterior shifts essentially the value of the parameters. This is an example that shows for the binomial distribution that the beta distribution is a conjugate prior. Now you can see it turns out that all exponential distributions have conjugate priors, and that's one of the reasons why we're so quick to model problems using exponential distributions. If you go into other areas of statistics and estimation theory, you may come across something called a mixture of exponentials, what's often called a mixture of experts in the artificial intelligence literature. And that's another example of why they do that. It's amenable to this kind of an analysis. Okay. So now we can sort of work up a little bit and look at what happens for the case of a multinomial distribution and then ultimately a multivariate Gaussian. So a generalization of the binomial distribution is called a multinomial distribution, and that describes the probability of k possible outcomes given n independent trials, where x sub I is the number of times the kth outcome is observed. So this is a distribution which fits more nicely with our concept of Gaussian mixture coefficients, because we're going to remember, if you remember the re-estimation process for those mixture coefficients, essentially estimated how many times a particular Gaussian was used over how many times it could have been used. So we can think of that as kind of as a count involving independent trials. So this distribution is simply a product of these individual probabilities. Instead of just having two, where we have p and we have 1 minus p, we have p sub k of these probabilities, though the very last one you could say is these all have to sum to 1. So there's even though there's k of them, there's sort of like k minus 1 degrees of freedom. And we can actually write a form for this distribution, which is n factorial over x1 factorial, x2 factorial, and so forth, times these probabilities, p sub 1 of x1, and so forth. Now, the conjugate prior for this is what's known as a Dirichlet density, and that's essentially something that looks very similar. We have x sub I raised to the alpha sub I minus 1 power, and it's divided by this function b, and this function b is it's also sort of like the beta distribution, beta function. It's a ratio of a product of gamma functions over a gamma function of the sum of the alphas. Now, I won't even attempt, I'm not going to prove this, but this conjugate prior was used when we wanted to estimate the mixture weights using MAP for the HMM. And that was one of the kind of the three key steps in that distribution, was the introduction of this as the conjugate prior for the mixture coefficients. The other sort of unknown distribution that we encountered was the case where we wanted to then estimate the multivariate Gaussian. We had a multivariate Gaussian distribution with unknown mean and variance, and actually what's used is precision, which is the inverse of the covariance. And we'll actually see an example of that when we go through this variance derivation. This was for the case where we have these Gaussian mixture distributions, and each mixture component has a mean and a covariance associated with it. And we wanted then to estimate the posterior based on the sum of those mixture components. And therefore, we needed a conjugate prior for those means and covariances. Now, the conjugate prior for a Gaussian, for a multivariate Gaussian distribution in this context is what's known as a normal Wishart distribution. And it has a couple components. There's an important assumption here. We have to estimate the means and the covariances. And you could argue that the means and covariances could have completely different prior distributions associated with them. What's typically done is to assume that you can actually decouple the joint prior between the mean, than the covariances as a product of the prior for the means and the prior for the covariances or the precision. And that's why this is a normal Wishart distribution, because the prior for the mean we're going to assume is essentially proportional to a Gaussian distribution. And the prior for the covariances is actually what's called a Wishart distribution. And it turns out the prior for the precision, which is the inverse of the covariance matrix, is a Wishart distribution. The prior for the covariance, which is the inverse of the precision, is what's called an inverse Wishart distribution. So there's this inverted relationship. So for the precision, the prior is a normal Wishart distribution. Now, this is an even more interesting animal to deal with, because if you think about this, the covariance is a matrix. When we have a vector, when we have a scalar, it's easy to think about a scalar Gaussian distribution associated with that. When we have a vector, it's relatively easy to think about a multivariate Gaussian distribution. But when we have a matrix, you know, what do we think about? A multi-matrix? You know, that concept doesn't quite exist. Well, that is what a Wishart distribution is. If you remember, a matrix is just a convenient way of writing lots of equations. We could represent the matrix as a long vector, which with sub-elements, which were rows or columns of the matrix. And then we could have a multivariate Gaussian distribution associated with that. What's done instead is to write that as what's called a Wishart distribution, which has two key components. It's proportional to the determinant of the matrix, and this is when we're talking about precision. And then it has this exponential term, which is the trace of a matrix U, which is the covariance of the mean vectors, and times the precision matrix R. And then when you take the trace, if you remember, the trace is just diagonal elements of that product of those two matrices. So you get back to a sort of a vector type function, but it's done in terms of the trace of this matrix U times R. So this normal Wishart distribution was used to model the priors for the means and covariances in the Gaussian mixture distribution in an HMM. So when we put all this together, we have the priors for the mixture weights and the priors for the means and covariances. And we had all that together, and then that's what we tried to use to develop the map equations for estimation of the HMM parameters. Okay, and that's, I think, hopefully that, you know, as you go back and look at that paper, this will make a little more sense. At least you'll know where these things came from. And the conjugate priors in general, if you ever take a course on Bayesian statistics, you'll see them used extensively. One of the books that we work from for this and is this book by Lee on Bayesian statistics and introduction, and that's actually where you'll find it's a nice, relatively introductory text that goes through this variance derivation and talks pretty extensively about the conjugate priors in a fairly readable way. Okay, so that's sort of the first thing I wanted to talk about was, what is a conjugate prior? Now, why did I want to talk about those? Well, if you remember, when we estimated the mean, we kind of introduced conjugate prior, but fortunately, since it was Gaussian, we didn't have too much complexity. When we tried to estimate the variance of a Gaussian distribution using MAP, we have to invoke the Wishart distribution, and we have to use conjugate prior. So now what I'd like to do is to go through that derivation and show you how we can re-estimate the variance of a Gaussian distribution using that adaptation. So we have our observations, and I'm following the notation we use for the mean. So we have n observation vector, n observations, and what we're going to do to make this simple, we're going to assume a scalar Gaussian random variable with a mean and variance. You know how to estimate the mean. The mean is estimated assuming that the variance is fixed. And then once you estimate the mean, then you go back and estimate the variance assuming the mean is fixed. So the equations that we'll end up with do make use of the map estimate of the mean. And we just, like I said, we flip back and forth. Now, alternately, you could try to estimate the mean and variance simultaneously. But if you try to do that, you will end up with a set of nonlinear equations, and you'll have to use some kind of linear equation solver. And my guess is that if you did that, the solutions that you get would probably not be anything better than what you get when you do it sequentially. And that's probably why people haven't done it. Okay, so the likelihood of the variance given the data, we're going to write that as the probability of O given sigma squared. Well, this is a distribution. This is a likelihood. This is essentially the multivariate Gaussian distribution we said, assuming independence of the O's. And what we're going to do to make this a little simpler is we're going to ignore some of the constants, the two pi's, and we're just going to write that this is proportional, this likelihood is proportional to sigma squared raised to the minus n over 2 power. We have a square root in the denominator, we have an n of these, so we have minus n over 2 power times the exponential. We have e to the sigma sub o sub I minus mu squared over 2 sigma squared. That's just sort of our Gaussian or quadratic term. Now, we're going to simplify this a little bit, just make the notation a little simpler. We're going to define a term called S, which is essentially the sample covariance, but it's not quite, because we don't normalize by the number of elements. So we're going to define S as the sum from I equals 1 to N of O sub I minus mu quantity squared. And that's going to allow us to write that this likelihood of the data given the variance is proportional to sigma squared raised to the minus n over 2 power times e to the minus s over 2 sigma squared. So it just makes things a little simpler. But we're going to use this value s again. So please remember that this is just it's the variance. And to compute this requires knowledge of the mean. So if we're talking about a prior value of this, we're going to need some training data and a prior value of the mean. If we're talking about estimating this on the actual new data, the n data samples, then we have those n data samples, but we also are going to want to use our map estimate for the mean. And that's where we begin to see now the sequential nature of this estimation process. Okay, so the posterior then is the likelihood multiplied by the prior. So we have P of sigma squared given O, the observations, is proportional to P of O given sigma squared times P of sigma squared. And therefore, we can write this as sigma squared to the minus n over 2, e to the minus s over 2 sigma squared times the prior P of sigma squared. Now, once again, we have the usual problem of what to assume for the prior distribution, this P of sigma squared. In the case of the Gaussian likelihood for estimate for the mean, we used a Gaussian mean as the conjugate prior. I would like to use a Gaussian prior for the variance. And that's sort of the Gaussian prior of the variance, which means you're going to have a mean value for the variance and a mean and a variance of the variance. Yeah, I always forget these really key words like does not. Okay, so please note in this next sentence there's a typo. But in this case, assuming a Gaussian prior does not satisfy our condition for a conjugate prior. And even if we did persevere with that assumption, the equations that would result are too complicated. So instead, we... as I mentioned, if we actually pursued that numerical solution of those equations, I'm not sure we would get any better performance. So the question is there a better choice for this prior? Something that's more tractable, yet doesn't really decrease the modeling power of this approach? And the answer, of course, is yes, there is. The conjugate prior for the variance in this case is what's called a normal Wishart form for precision. And as we talked about, it's an normal inverse Wishart for the variance. And the Wishart distribution in this case of a single parameter reduces to an inverse chi-square distribution. And that's actually, Wishart's are a generalization of the chi-square distribution. So that's one of the ways they came about. So what we're going to assume, so for the scalar case, what does that look like? Well, what that looks like is we have the prior of sigma squared is going to be proportional to sigma squared raised to the minus kappa over 2 times e to the minus s0 over 2 sigma squared. Now, so this is essentially very much like the distribution that we already have, except that we have these new parameters, kappa and s0. Now, s0, this is a prior distribution, right? So s0 is still the sample variance. It's still the sum of observations minus mu zero, that sum square, the sum of the squares. And kappa is another degree of freedom. So now we've got these two degrees of freedom, kappa and S0. S0 is written in terms of mu zero. Mu zero is essentially the prior value of the mean. Now, again, you know, that's a problem. We don't know necessarily these prior values. We don't know the prior value of the mean. We don't know the prior value of the variance or this kappa or whatever other degrees of freedom that you want to give to this expression. However, we can, if I give you a pot of data, I give you a set of data, and we call this the prior data or the training data, you can fit this distribution to that data, and you could do a numerical optimization to find this kappa and this S0. They're just essentially the degrees of freedom of this distribution that you can optimize to match the data. S0 has a fairly straightforward interpretation because it's related to the variance. And all we really need is to know is the mean of that prior data to estimate S0. Now, in the pattern recognition course, we discuss many different ways you could actually optimally estimate these parameters given a set of data. One simple way to estimate these, the prior mean we can get fairly simply. Give me a large amount of training data, and I just compute the mean. I could also take that data, and then what we also need essentially is not just the mean, but we also need the variance of the, and you know, please remember here that we're dealing with the prior distribution of the variance. So if I give you this data, one thing that you can do, how would you estimate the expected value of the variance of that data? Well, you know how to estimate the variance from the data. You just take the mean, some squares of the mean minus the data. But how would you estimate the expected value of the variance from a data set? Well, if you think about that long enough, and you take the pattern, or you take the pattern recognition course, and my pattern recognition students, if they're awake this morning, could tell you the answer to this. You guys want to try to answer that? How we can actually estimate the variance from a data set? Not the variance of the data. We need the mean of the estimate of the variance, which is the expected value of the variance. And we need the variance of the variance. So one way we can do that, that's, you might say, a little bit cheating, but it's actually not a bad technique, is you take the data, let's say you have 100 points, and you partition it into 10 sets of 10 points, and you estimate the mean and the variance of each of those 10 sets, and then you estimate the expected value of the mean by averaging the 10 means that you estimated and averaging the 10 variances that you estimated. This is a process that's often called jackknifing, and it's a fairly well-known technique in machine learning. So there are ways that we can estimate these prior values, and I'll come back to that at the end of the derivation. But for the moment, let's just assume these are degrees of freedom, and we know how we can estimate those. We don't have to worry about those for the rest of the derivation. This kappa parameter, it's a parameter that we introduce to allow the prior to have a similar form to the likelihood, but it also gives us some degree of freedom to optimize the prior to better match our beliefs of the data. And we can estimate kappa from the prior training data. Kappa is actually somewhat related to the number of data points that you have. It's a degree of freedom, which is common in this literature when you talk about things like chi-squares and such. It's another parameter that can be estimated. Now, to further confuse things a little, it'll be convenient to define a variable called nu, which is equal to kappa minus 2. This is just a definition for convenience so that what we end up with formally looks like a chi-square distribution. It's not critical to the derivation, but it's just convenient to make it all look kind of nice and clean. So if we combine all these things, then we have that the posterior of the variance given the data is equal to the prior, which is sigma squared, and then for kappa we replace it with this nu minus 2. So we have nu over 2 minus 1. And then we have e to the minus s 0 over 2 sigma squared. And then we have our likelihood, which is sigma squared raised to the minus n over 2 times e to the minus s over 2 sigma squared. And again, we'll throw away some of the constants and we'll regroup this so that we can write this as sigma squared raised to the nu plus n power over 2 minus 1. That comes about from combining this term with this term. And we will combine the S0 and the S. Remember, S0 is the covariance essentially computed on the training data. S is the covariance computed on the new data. So this is a very nice, compact representation for the posterior. And now in the map method, what we're going to want to do is to maximize this with respect to which parameters? MAP method, what are we going to try to maximize this with respect to? So the MAP method essentially says we want to maximize this term, make the posterior as large as possible. With the maximization is occurring with respect to what? What's our goal? What's our overall goal in this? You know, pick a parameter. You got like a one out of five chance there. Guess the right thing. What's our overall goal? Let's not lose sight of our overall goal. What are we trying to estimate?
The what?
So we talked about conjugate priors. We talked about conjugate priors because I wanted to use them to achieve what? MAP estimation of the MAP estimation of the variance, right? Okay. So this is our posterior of the variance given the data. What is this? In words, what this is this is essentially the probability of a particular value of the variance given the data. There's many possible values the variance could have. You as an expert in this area could say, well, I think the variance is zero. I think the variance is one. That's an estimate, right? If you're a good guesser, that may be the best thing to do. But what we're going to try to do in the Bayesian or the MAP approach is we're going to try to maximize this probability. We're going to try to choose the sigma squared, which maximizes this probability. Hopefully, that's the best possible estimate of the sigma squared. All right, I'm seeing some really blank faces here. How are we doing out there in Oxford? Equally blank? We okay? All right. The resolution's so low, I can't really see the expressions on your face. But they're definitely, we're lost here in the classroom. Previously, what did we do? We developed a way to estimate the mean using maximum a posteriori. What does that mean? That means we're maximizing the probability, we're choosing the value of the mean that maximizes the posterior distribution for the mean given the data. It seems like that would be the best guess you could possibly make. It's the most likely guess. It's the value, or what's called the mode, that is most likely, right? What other guess would you choose? Well, you know, this is what separates gamblers from statisticians. Statisticians estimate these values from the data. Gamblers perhaps pick these values based on other considerations. You can think of this as a poker game. When computers play poker, they take moves which are the most probable moves based on knowledge of what all the different cards are. They maximize these posteriors, essentially. What poker players do, they take a guess based on how strategies and other considerations, reading the players and such. What we're trying to do here is simply to choose the value of sigma squared, which maximizes this posterior. And what we're trying to do, we have a prior value. We're assuming that somehow we can estimate a prior value of the variance from a large amount of training data. The question we're trying to answer here is, if I give you n new data points, so you've got, you know, billions of old data, you've got a mean, you've got a variance, and whatever else about that data. Now I give you these n new data points. What's the best value of the variance to use to model those data points? Now, you know, as we've talked about this a few times now, that Before you walked into this class, you would have most likely simply estimated the variance on those n data points, those n new data points, and not worried about all your prior training data. But what we're showing here with map adaptation is a way of mixing your knowledge about the prior data and your estimates of the new data in a way that maximizes this posterior. So, what is it in this expression, when we try to maximize this, what is it we're maximizing it with respect to? There's a few variables here. There's new, there's n, there's S0, there's S, there's sigma squared. We're trying to maximize this with respect to sigma squared. Okay? Well, it turns out it's convenient to maximize this with respect to 1 over sigma squared simply because that allows the 1 over the inverse resembles a chi-squared distribution. The variance resembles an inverse chi-squared distribution. So what we'll actually do is make a substitution, let lambda be 1 over sigma squared, and then we'll maximize this with respect to lambda, but that essentially gives us the same solution as for 1 over sigma squared. So we can differentiate this expression with respect to lambda to obtain the map solution. So we take this expression as a function of lambda. We differentiate it with respect to lambda. Well, if you differentiate this, we have lambdas appearing here and lambdas appearing here, so we have to apply the product rule, which says the derivative of the first times the second plus the derivative of the second times the first. We set that equal to zero and we solve for lambda. There should be an n there. It's a typo. I'll fix that later. So we have, for the derivative of the first, we have, this is just a function raised to a power, so we have the power times the function raised to the decreased power. So we subtract the minus 1, so this plus 1 here cancels, and we have nu plus n over 2, lambda raised to the nu plus n over 2 power times nu plus n over 2 plus 1. For the second term, this is a function of the form e to the x, so we have, or e to the ax, so we have a times the derivative times the function e to the ax times the derivative of the argument with respect to lambda, so we get the lambda raised to the nu plus n over 2 plus 1 e to the ax type, and then we have the derivative of the argument with respect to lambda, which is just minus s0 over plus s over 2. So we set that equal to 0, put one of these over on the right-hand side, and we get things work out pretty nicely. The exponential terms cancel, and we're left with lambda map, and we can actually divide by this nu plus n over 2 power, and what's nice about that is we have nu plus n over 2 plus 1 here, we have nu plus n over 2 here, so when we do that division, we're just left with lambda to the power 1 on the right-hand side. So we have nu plus n over 2 plus 1 is equal to lambda times s0 plus s over 2. So lambda map is equal to nu plus n plus 2 over s0 plus s, which means sigma squared map, which was 1 over lambda, is s0 plus s divided by nu plus n over 2. Voila. Now, can somebody explain to me why that makes sense? Oh, I thought you were pointing to him. Does that make sense? This is actually an interesting result, especially at 1 in the morning. So, what is S? Do we know S? We've got old data, we've got new data. Do we know S?
A
Okay, the answer is yes. Good. What? How do we estimate S? That's just the sample covariance, right? The sum of O's minus mu. Knowing we need the maximum likelihood estimate of the mu, of the mean. But once we have mu map, we can estimate S. What is S0? It's the old one, right? So we can also estimate that. So isn't it interesting that the maximum likelihood estimate of the variance says just add these two together? Take all the old data, right? It's essentially taking all the old data, taking all the new data, and computing the variance. But it's doing the old data with respect to the mean of the old data, the new data with respect to the mean of the new data, and then adding those two contributions. So it's not simply adding the data, it's not simply pooling the data, it's actually pooling the covariance or the variance term, the data minus the respective mean. Now, and then it's scaled. This is another interesting thing. It's scaled not by n. The sum n represents the number of data points we have in S, right? So if this was just 1 over n times the sum of O minus mu squared, that would be a traditional variance. But what's interesting about this is that we're adding to that the number of training data points. So you would expect, if you were going to divide by some normalization factor, you would expect to divide by the number of old data points plus the number of new data points. But we're actually dividing by new plus 2, okay? And now, unfortunately, we have to estimate new. But let's go back and look at what new was. New, so we have new plus n plus 2. But new was just kappa minus 2. So new plus n plus 2 is just kappa plus n. Kappa was our parameter associated with our prior, and kappa is loosely related to the number of data points in the prior data. So, fortunately, this map estimate actually looks very reasonable. It looks like all we're really doing here is adding the variances from these two terms. These are computed with different means, however, but we're dividing by the total number of points, essentially. Now, I'm still not okay with that. I think somehow there's a couple things you would have expected. You might have expected these to be mixed in proportion to the number of points in each one of those terms. Right? If I give you 100 data points and I tell you the average is 10, and I give you 10 new data points and I tell you the average is 20, and then I ask you this would be a good final exam question, what is the average, what is the true average? How would you compute that? So, to put this, we always like to put this in financial perspective, right? Then that wakes you up and makes you think about these things. So, the price of Lehman Brothers for the past 50 years, let's say, has been 100. The price of Lehman Brothers in the past 3 weeks has been like 1. Your job as an analyst is to estimate what's the true value of Lehman's average price. Now, before you answer that quickly, did this get the people out in Oxford woken up? Because you guys have like 401ks, right? Or 403bs? Now, before you answer that, note that Warren Buffett is investing heavily in the stock market right now. Why is Warren Buffett investing heavily in the stock market? Can our people out in Oxford answer that? So what's his estimate of the mean value of... Lehman's is not a good example because they're in bankruptcy. A little bit of a problem. But, you know, what's his estimate of the mean for, let's say, I don't know, GM or Walmart or whoever? Right. So in drawing his estimate of the mean, he's weighting the prior data more heavily, right? He's assuming that the current mean is below what the true mean is, if you will. So I hope you can see that that's what we have here. Essentially, we have the prior variance plus the new variance, but we're mixing these. Now,
I mean, we still can place more emphasis on the new variance. It's just the, different viewpoint.
No, I'm still, we could talk about this all day, but I'm trying to draw out some of the subtleties here. If there's a lot more, remember, this is the sum of O minus mu. It's not 1 over N times O minus mu. Right? This is, let me go back to the slide where... This is an unnormalized sum of the data squared, right? So if there's a large number of points in S0 and a small number of points in S, when you add these two sums together, especially because it's a quadratic, which sum is going to dominate? The prior sum, right? Because it's got a lot more terms. It has 100 terms instead of 10 terms. So, I'm still a little uncomfortable with this because I think I would have expected to see some kind of weighting of these two based on the number of data points, perhaps. This is heavily biased towards the prior data. Would you?
No, I think this makes sense because as we get new data,
This will converge. I'm not saying this won't converge.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But if you think about the typical situation, we have large amounts of prior data and small amounts of new data. This is a different result than the mean. The mean turned out nicely. We had some control over how we weighted these two, right? Here, the weighting is... It's not quite... There's not a whole lot of control over this.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you have much more prior data than new data, the prior data is going to dominate. Now, you will see this derivation, you know, you see this result in many, many books and this and that. And variance adaptation is often, and this is another reason, Sundar and I have been talking about the fact that it's rare that you see people actually do variance adaptation in speech processing, for example. And I think the reason for that is, if you look at this result, there's no real argument to do it because the new variance is essentially going to be the old variance. But I wonder if that's an artifact of some of the assumptions that we've made. And I wonder if, if you look at the stock market example we give, you've got stocks right now with really low average values over the recent days and really high prior average values. If you use this estimate, what's your investment strategy going to be? You're going to do exactly what Warren Buffett is doing, which is investing in the stock market, because he would argue all the means are lower than they should be. but there's been such a dramatic environmental change, there's a lot of investors saying, no, it's going to take years for these stocks to come back to their true values. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to buy because they still may be dropping. So just, you know, philosophical view, or it's, these are really interesting results. I think that's what, why I really like a lot of the statistics. It really makes you think about the implications of some of these estimates. But there's a very, you know, this is an interesting result. It's not a perfect result by any means, I would say. Now, we do have these values S0 and nu. And if we have prior knowledge of the mean and variance based on some estimates of the training data, we can actually derive expressions for nu and S0 in terms of means and variances. That's something that you might find a little more palatable, because you can easily compute the mean and the variance on the prior data, and then you can compute the corresponding values of S0 and nu. And there's a number of ways to do that. Now, in this derivation, it's common that people will assume an inverse chi-squared distribution for the variance, so that we can then take the actual data means and variances and equate them to the parameters of this distribution and then solve for nu and S0. This is just one way, though, I want to emphasize, this is just one way of actually getting nu and S0 in terms of the mean of the variance and the variance of the variance. And as I explained earlier, you can estimate the mean of the variance, which is the expected value of the variance, and the variance of the variance on the training data by taking the big set of training data, chopping it up into small sets, and then estimating the means and variances in each one of those small sets, and then taking the average value of those means to get the expected value of the mean of the variance, and then taking the variance of those values to get the expected, to get essentially the variance of the variance. What's also done often, don't just do that once, but to permute the data so that you get lots of different partitionings of the data, and hopefully you get a better estimate of these things. So if you do that, the equations that you end up with is that nu is equal to the mean squared times 2 over sigma squared plus 4, and S0 is equal to the mean of the mean of the variance times nu minus 2. So this is a different way to estimate nu and S0 from the prior data. So we can summarize then the entire map process. You're given a set of training data. The first thing that you want to do is to estimate the expected value of the variance. That's what we're calling mu sub sigma squared, and the variance of the variance. That's what we're calling sigma squared sub sigma squared. That's the variance of the variance. And as we explained, you can do that by chopping the training data up. From those values, having this mu and this sigma, you can estimate S0 and nu. Once you have S0 and nu, the additional piece of information we need is two things, actually. I forgot to include them. We need the maximum likelihood estimate of the mean, which is going to be computed using the equations we previously derived. And from that, then we can estimate S as simply being the variance, assuming that the mean is the maximum, the MAP mean. And then once we have S, S0, and nu, we can then go in and estimate the MAP estimate for sigma squared, which is just S0 plus S over nu plus N plus 2. So the process for estimating the MAP estimate of the mean is fairly simple, the MAP estimate of the variance, rather. The MAP estimate of the mean we saw two lectures ago was also fairly simple. But, you know, you may have seen equations that look like this in textbooks before and not really known why are they divided by N plus 1, N plus 2. That's where all this kind of thing comes from.
I have a problem. you assume chi-square, but how you got those, I mean, chi-square?
I assumed.
So, yeah.
That's a problem. I agree, it's a problem. It's an assumption. It's yet another assumption. You see, that's why people have been critical of the Bayesian approaches. The Bayesian people say, oh, we're better than MAP and MLE because we take into account prior information. But the MAP and MLE people say, but wait a second, you're making assumptions about, instead of assuming, making assumptions about the mean, you're making assumptions about the distributions of the mean, and so you're still making assumptions, potentially worse assumptions. So that's why I said there's many ways we can estimate these parameters. This is just one that the statisticians have used.
So if I am lucky, I got a correct assumption about assumption, then I can estimate the new assumption.
Right. Now, what I will say in defense of the Bayesian people is that what they're doing is postulating a shape of the distribution, and then they're optimizing the shape of that distribution from the data. So there is a potentially more powerful optimization in play. Okay, but yeah, it's a very, very valid criticism. I think in this class, I'm hoping, since this is a really advanced class, you understand the things I'm presenting to you are just one of many possible techniques. They're neither right nor wrong for your application, right? They're loaded with assumptions. Those assumptions may not be relevant to your application. Okay? But given you're willing to accept all those assumptions, the actual equations are not too bad. That's kind of remarkable that, you know, the equations turn out to be so simple. So Sundar programmed this up in MATLAB. He generated 5,000 Gaussian values with a mean and variance. And then he ran them, he generated, and I think the mean for that data was what, 2? Was that, I think I'm reading this right?
Yeah.
And then he generated 2,000 data points with a mean of 2.5 using Gaussian random number generator. And then he applied these MAP equations to see, as I start adding 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 new points, how does the MAP estimate converge? And you see the MAP estimate of the mean converges fairly quickly, but you also do see a little bit of the oscillatory behavior, and it eventually settles down at about 1,000 points. Then he also did the same for the variance adaptation, and so you'll see the variance kind of adapts pretty quickly, but also has a somewhat larger oscillation. But remember here that the variance, the mean has actually changed, right? So that it takes a few sample points for the variance to adapt to that. So this is a good example because it shows you the need to adapt the variance. Because the variance was kept fixed in this sooner, or was the variance, did the variance also change? We can look at the code, I guess. So at the end of the lecture notes, I attached the you changed the variance also. We should have written that on the slide. So he generated 5,000 points with a mean of 2 and a variance of 1.1. And then he generated 2,000 points with a mean of 2.5 and a variance of 1.5. So the mean and variance changed, and you can see kind of nice. You can see how quickly they adapt. Now, one of the things I'd like you to do is to go and overlay the MLR method estimates on the exact same data. And I think what we'll see, I think that the MAP will adapt faster, if I remember right.
MAP should be slower.
Slower?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll see. I think for this case, I thought MAP was faster, but for the speech cases, MAP is slower.
Yeah.
Because
for speech cases, it's slower.
Yeah. So, and a couple lectures ago, I presented some results where I showed on a speech recognition application how MAP compares to MLR for like a real system. We didn't talk about the details of the real system. So this is, so we now have MLR and MAP as two fundamentally different adaptation techniques from what we talked about in the first half of the course. And I hope you're finding this worthwhile. And with that, I think that's a TV theme show, isn't it? I will end the lecture for today.